It's January 5th, 2000. This evening, the Historical Society will have Jeannie Ferguson. Her married name is Jeannie Smith, giving us a little story on the Ferguson family and probably about some others in Cumberland as well. Thank you.
Welcome to our first meeting for the year 2000. And this is going to be a special event for me tonight because our guest speaker tonight, Jeannie Smith, has known me since I was 12 years old. She was a lot younger than that, of course, but we go back a long time. We've been neighbors for all that time because we're neighbors in the Cumberland Village on lots 13 and 14. That's between the highway and the river. And we've seen each other go along for all these years. And Jeannie is a teacher. She's made a career of teaching. She teaches at Riverview Public School in Cumberland. She's written some local history articles in the weekly journal, and you'll see some of them lined up there. She's also the curator of the Cumberland branch of the Tweedsmuir Histories. That's local history. And she has musical talents, and I think she told me that we might see a bit more of that tonight. I really want to talk about, well, this is one thing I have to say. She was born Jean Elizabeth Ferguson. Her great-grandfather was Dr. James Ferguson. She's going to tell us all about that. He was a doctor in the township for some 60 years, between 1862 and 1921, roughly. So Jeannie is a fourth-generation resident of the township. Way back. And I really want to hear what she has to say to us tonight because it should be very interesting.
Thanks, Bob. I'm going to start out with a song. Hi, come on in. Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. Welcome, welcome. Hi there.
Hi.
I'm going to start out with a song that I wrote for the opening of this library and sang last spring, I guess it was. And when I wrote the song, I wrote it as if I was my great-grandmother, Susanna Rice McLaren Ferguson. So I'm singing as if I'm old Susanna. When I first came to this land, it wasn't known as Cumberland, Fulbearville, then Osborne by name. In 1802, the settlers came. In 63, I moved from Riceville, came in Cumberland. My family lives there still. My husband was James Ferguson. For 60 years, he doctored everyone. I got married in 63, moved to Cumberland, raised a family. They all prospered in Cumberland, became doctors, nurses, teachers, and helping hands. The path along the river was an Indian trail, became a dirt road, then pavement by a rail. The train passed by where the highway now goes. The river to the north still constantly flows. Influenza 1918, death hit Cumberland like we've never seen. I died and left my family. Ancestors fond, they remember me. Treasure the history of this land, a place that's special, Cumberland. Rural and urban, together they stand, welcoming newcomers with a friendly hand. When I first came to this land, it wasn't known as Cumberland. Fulbearville, then Osborne by name. When Cumberland, and I put down, this is an old song, because I said, when Cumberland and Gloucester join, there'll be a new name. Cumberland, Slumberland, how my soul delights in your beauty as I view the rolling hills to the north and the gentle slope of the riverbanks of that mighty blue ribbon of the Ottawa waters. This sense of pride and heartfelt warmth has been handed down to me from four generations of my family who have dwelt on this strip of land in Cumberland Village. And I've started up here with David Ferguson, married Janet Dunn. He was born in Scotland in 1780. and his son William married Margaret McCandlish, and they came out in 1836. My great-grandfather James, my grandpa John, J.D., some of you may remember old J.D., and my father, and my mother is here tonight. I'm so lucky to have Mama here, and myself, and my husband, and I believe there might be some cousins to James Cameron Glenwood Smith here too, some Smith people, and my son Brett John Smith. My great-grandfather, James Ferguson, was born in 1838 in Caledonia Springs, just north of Van Wyck Hill, to William Ferguson, born May 24th, Mosshead, 1803. And William died at Cumberland in 1884. And Margaret McCandlish, who was born in 1810 in Dumfries, and she died in 1863 at Van Wyck Hill. They had emigrated from Kells, Kirkcudbrightshire, Scotland in 1836 with four young children. William had been commissioned as architect to construct stone buildings, the hotel in Caledonia Springs, mills in Thurso, Perkins, and the church in Van Wyck Hill. William's father, David, was born in 1780, and mother was Janet Dunn. My great-great-grandfather, William, was a strong man, 6'3", 250 pounds. If you have seen my son, Brett, you'll see where he gets that from. It was told him that at a fire in the main store in Van Wyck Hill, he went alone into the basement where supplies were rolled down a ramp for storage. But with no ramp being in position, the opening level was almost breast high. William, in the emergency, tossed out 198-pound barrels of pork all by himself. My great-grandfather, James, was educated at Van Wyck Hill, and he taught school at the Swamp School in Van Wyck Hill, then in Almont, to earn college tuition. He had been highly thought of as a teacher, and he received 3 bolts of suit cloth from the Almont Mills in appreciation for preparing 3 young men for college. James then entered McGill College, and it was known as McGill College at that time, in 1858, to study medicine. Now, at that time, a medical student had to produce his own cadaver for dissection and study. James and his classmates, McLeod and McDonald, were in Van Wyck Hill over the Christmas holidays, and they went to a graveyard and they obtained, dare I say stole, the body of a young 18-year-old Scottish girl. News traveled quickly, and the trio were chased out of Upper Canada by the Klansmen, and they escaped to Montreal, where they were hidden by a professor. Years later, James showed my father a newspaper clipping which he had pasted in a lecture notebook. Scottish Klansmen, enraged at body snatching, chased 3 young McGill medical students out of town. McLeod was captured, but Ferguson and McDonald escaped. My great-grandfather slipped off to New York City, where he completed his studies at Columbia University, and he graduated in the spring of 1861. This experience afforded him practice in dressing and treating wounded soldiers of the American Civil War. Later in 1861, James visited a Dr. Ferguson, no relation, in Buckingham, Quebec, who had to travel south across the Ottawa River to Cumberland, which at that time was known as Faubertville, then Osborne. It was G.G. Dunning that changed the name to Osborne, probably about in the early 1860s. And great-grandfather went to Cumberland to treat an ailing shoemaker, John Allen. Now, John Allen would be Freddie Jones' grandfather, they told me. The patient's foot was badly infected, and the old doctor prescribed amputation. Young Dr. Ferguson, using his knowledge of treating gangrenous wounds of the Union soldiers, healed John Allen, and the shoemaker convalesced to walk on both legs as good as new. This cure brought fame to James, and local people in the village insisted that he become the resident physician. So about 1862, he set up a medical practice in a corner room of the Wilson store and post office, which Angus talked about, and then later in a log house, which is now at the museum, but we always knew it as Spratt House. Heidel Boss lived in there in Moffat's for a while. Many of you know that old spot. James then acquired land in Cumberland Village from Amable Foubert on November 29, 1865, and he built his red brick house, Chestnut Cottage. While studying in Montreal in 1858, James had met Susanna Rice McLaren at a boarding house. Susanna was born in 1842, her sister Mariah in 1844, and brothers Abner, 1840, and John in 1846. They were all at school in Montreal. Susanna and John attended normal school, and John became principal of Stansted College at Lennoxville for about a year and a half. Then, in 1861, John went on to study law at McGill, and he apprenticed himself as a student to Strawn Bethune, who was nephew of Bishop Strawn. Now, the McLaurins came from Riceville, and we have a fellow over here. I think he was born near that area, Dave. Maybe you're related. Their grandfather was Dr. Abner Rice, who was a United Empire loyalist, and he had settled in St. Andrews West near Cornwall in 1814. And he had an extensive professional practice as well as was a gentleman farmer on 200 acres of land south of Plantagenet. Now you're probably wondering where I'm getting all of this information, but this was written by my father, a lot of it, and my dad was born in 1904. So this history would have been told to him by his great-grandfather. So, you know, it's really a very primary source. I can show you actually after where I've gotten it from. In Canada at that time, medical men had nothing to boast of in regard to ability or skill, and it would be difficult to tell from what college they were graduated. All diseases were for the most part treated with liberal doses of calomel and jalap, together with the free use of the lancet in cases of surgery. Heaven help the poor wretch who required their services. Now, Dr. Rice, along with Drs. Beach and Ellis, were a better educated class that settled in the country, and he used to ride the Indian trails to see his patients and to oversee his farm. He established the community at Riceville. His wife was a Miss Hobarth, who was niece of the Vice President Hobarth, and their 13th child, Mariah, who was born in Vermont in 1813, married Peter McLaurin, born in 1804, who had emigrated from Perthshire to Breadalbane in Glengarry in 1812. Now, Peter McLaurin's father, John, had received a 100-acre grant of land from the Crown located at Breadalbane, which is 30 miles south of Riceville. Peter's brother, John McLaurin Jr., became editor of the Bytown Gazette, which later was merged into the Free Press and the Citizen. My great-great-grandfather, Peter McLaurin, built a stone flour mill on the Scotch River, then he ran a store and post office in Riceville. Shortly after his marriage to Mariah Rice, Peter had his nephew Duncan McEwen manage the mills, and he went to study in Quebec to become a provincial land surveyor. He practiced his profession along with the other sole land surveyor, James Hamilton, throughout Prescott and Russell counties. His wife, Mariah, died September 21st, 1862, only at the age of 49. And on her monument in Riceville, the little church, if anyone knows that area, is the little, I think it used to be the Baptist church, and there's that road going up in the cemetery right at the back. On her tombstone, it says, "In memory of Mariah Rice, wife of Peter McLaurin, Mariah sweetly does repose. Calmly she, with sealed assurance, slept to rise as Jesus rose." She was the person after whom this place was called Riceville, on account of which her name will not be forgotten, as well as being engraved on the hearts of those who esteemed her. Now, Mariah and Captain R.W. Shepherd, who was a navigator of the steamships that went up the river just out of Lorignal, maybe you've heard his name, Mariah and Captain R.W. Shepherd's mother of Hudson Heights were first cousins. Miss de la Dernière was her maiden name. Now, Mariah's eldest daughter, Susanna, my great-grandma, had been teaching school. Mariah's eldest daughter, Susanna, was a school teacher also, and she was teaching school in Plantagenet while James completed his studies south of the border. She was very small in stature, but large in talent and in intelligence. She could sing, play piano, harp, and violin, and she was later capable in managing James's accounts and keeping track of mortgages that she held on land in the Cumberland area. A Cumberland dressmaker, Ellen Golightly, fashioned James's ruffled wedding shirt. I remember my father and I going into Mrs. Golightly's house just, you know, in the late 50s and 60s, and we found an old Bible and old books and so forth. But, you know, my father recalled these stories to me, and I'm so glad that I remembered them. And time that I took an interest in. I don't know if my son would take an interest. They kind of shake their head, you know, when you tell them these things. Susanna married James Ferguson March 17, 1863, and they traveled by horse and cutter from Riceville to their new home in Cumberland. They deferred their longer honeymoon trip until 1876 when they attended the Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia. James recalled his early experiences to my father, Douglas. At one time, he had his French-Canadian mare, Fanny, hitched to his gig, and he was coming home from the far south part of his territory on a dark night in the spring flood season. He was dead tired and had a red handkerchief tied around his head, and he was asleep with the horse on free rein. The horse stopped all at once, which act awakened James. He jumped out and found just in front that the bridge crossing the Bear Brook, and they called it the Bear Brook, it wasn't Bear Brook, it had just washed out by the spring freshet. On different occasions, he was chased by packs of wolves. One time, when on horseback, he was on the way home and a large pack of wolves came up behind him. He threw off his hat and then his coat, over which they wrangled, enabling him to outrun them. The wolves pounced on each garment that he threw off. This gave him a head start, but not enough, as he was obliged to throw off different pieces of wearing apparel before he reached home. On the opening of the roads through the virgin forest, he was one of the first to drive a French cart, then a buckboard, then a covered carriage. The automobile came just as he was retiring from active practice about 1912. Mrs. Jimmy Stevenson, William Hayes' sister, and that would be probably a great aunt of Doug Hayes, if anyone knew Doug. She sold clothes for my grandmother, Nettie, at Chestnut Cottage, and she told my father stories about the doctor that she had remembered from her youth. She said that she often had seen Susanna go out in the morning and open the big gate of in front of Chestnut Cottage to find her husband, James, sitting asleep on his gig or in his buckboard buggy with a red handkerchief tied around his head, the mare Fanny waiting patiently to get to the stable. In the many years that Dr. Ferguson practiced, he was, for much of the time, the only doctor in the territory, extending from Perkins Mills to Thurso in Quebec, and from the quarries over by Carson Grove to Russell Village and Plantagenet in Ontario. He kept four teams of horses which were driven in turn and rested, and he sometimes talked about the year of the deep snows of 1868. In some places it was 7 feet deep and the tunnels were dug out to go from house to barn. Having a personality which imparted confidence to all, people said of him that the patient felt better on hearing his voice when he entered, or the anxious father, once seeing his coat and hat on the door peg on coming from the barn, felt much relieved. Mrs. Bertha McCaffrey Edwards told me that she remembered my great-grandfather's kindly manner when he visited her home when she was a child. Mrs. Eva Hodges Carrier also told me that James saved her father Charlie's hand from amputation after it had been injured in a farm machine. Some of the fingers were lost, but the hand was healed well enough for Charlie Hodges to accompany his sons Claire and Wesley on the piano. And then another fellow, when I sang up at Queenswood Lodge, his name was Mr. Lalonde, and he apparently lived somewhere on the Navan Road. And he recalled how great-grandfather James had saved his father after his father had been shot in the chest by a rifle. Now, in the 1870s, legislation required all practitioners to be registered as licensed MDs, and James reviewed his work and passed the examinations with high standing. One examiner on the board asked how many cases he'd had of a certain disease, and on telling him, the examiner said, "You should be examining me. You know more about it than I do." Dr. Ferguson served as coroner for Prescott and Russell counties during many years of his practice. His oldest son, Willie, became doctor and coroner in Rockland until his early death in 1912. James and Willie had both been coroners at the inquest of the McGonigal Girl murders in 1890. And Anne Gono is here tonight, and I brought along with me the things that you managed to get for the McGonigal murders. Mm-hmm. And right in here it talks about great-grandfather and my great-uncle Willie, their testimony. You know, they might have been people actually who might have had to take the hands off. That's a gruesome story. Let's see. So my great-grandfather, my Uncle James, he was a doctor in Lancaster, New Hampshire for 60 years, and my dad was a dentist in Ottawa. My father was going to be a medical doctor, And my Uncle James, who was born in 1898, was the same age as Othello, if anyone knew of Vic Dunning. Many people might remember old Vic. And Vic and my Uncle James went to Lister together. And they went in on the old steamer and they boarded in town. And Vic was going to go to McGill to become a doctor like his brother Walter, except Vic decided to get married to Pearl instead. And my Uncle James and Vic were friends all their life, you know, and Vic, instead of doing the strawberries, he could have easily been a doctor. But my dad was going to become a doctor also. My father had taught school at French Hill for a few years, putting Uncle James through medical school. And then when Uncle James was established, he put my dad through medical school. He was going to put him through McGill, but father got scarlet fever and became very ill when he was very young, and then later on was able to become a dentist. My cousin Bruce is a pharmacist, and my Aunt Bessie was a nurse, as well as my sister Charlotte. So all of these relatives have carried out their medical duties with the same dedication, excellent bedside manner, and true human compassion that Dr. James Ferguson had bequeathed. Now, Dr. Ferguson, he was an eloquent speaker, so in the early years of his practice, he electioneered for W.C. Edwards. He was Reeve of Cumberland Township in the 1870s, and he was also asked to run for a Member of Parliament under Sir John A. Macdonald. And at that time, the old Bear Brook Road went straight south between the George Wilson, Angus Wilson's farm, and the Gregory G. Dunning farm for about three concessions. Then it moved west to where the fifth line, Dunning Road, runs. The reason was to escape a short rocky bluff about 3 miles south of Cumberland, where the Beatons live there now. As Reeve, Dr. Ferguson undertook to cut this cliff through and to grade it below in order to open the road. For years afterward, this was known as the Doctor's Hill and later became French Hill. My great-grandfather gave up political interests in life when he was influenced by a group of English evangelists who were led by Lord Adalbert Percy Cecil, John Nelson Darby, and James Dunlop. They were the Plymouth Brethren, and they were a branch. They were Irish to begin with, actually, and they were a branch of the Anglican Church that felt that the Anglican Church was just a little bit too pompous, and they started their own little branch, and they became quite severe and strict. No cards, no dancing, and certainly no drinking, you know. That's another story. They were called the Plymouth Brethren, and my great-grandfather built a gospel hall with an upstairs room for religious meetings that was on the corner of Queen and Fulbert. And maybe some of you can recall the stone steps. I can still remember them. But it burnt down in 1932. I don't think anybody in this room can remember that. And at the fire, there was a grass fire that started over at La Framboise's in By Haddad's, and it burnt that whole corner, and it burnt down the gospel hall. Now, Susanna and James had 9 children, but only 4 of them survived to become adults. Well, this is a picture here of about 1918 of my great-grandparents with one of their sons, Cecil, and his wife. I'll leave these up here, and you can have a look at them after. But their first son, William Dunlop Turner, you'll notice how all of the names have the Plymouth Brethren name with them. So Uncle Willie, he was William Dunlop Turner Ferguson, and he was born, this is all taken from the Ferguson Bible, actually. He was born in Cumberland, Canada West. At that time it was Canada West, January 31st, 1864, and he died in Europe in 1912. The next daughter was Ida Maria Hook Ferguson, known as Minnie. She was born August the 11th, 1866, and she died January 31st, 1891 from pneumonia. And mother, I remember always telling me that apparently the story was that Minnie died from pneumonia because she used to party over across the river in Buckingham. So this was always a threat to me when I was young in the 60s, getting out in my mini skirts that, you know, dress warmly because you don't want to end up getting pneumonia also. And my son, Brett, who was 18, he's a good chum with Matthew Hill and young Jason Minogue and Jeff Cotton. And these are all families that go back generations in Cumberland. And Brett says to me, Mom, I know a great place where you can get beer on Sunday. And I said, oh, where's that? Over in Massaw. So, I mean, when you look back in the family history, they've been going back there for generations. But poor Minnie, she was very young when she died. from pneumonia. The next one was Adelbert Percy Cecil Ferguson, Uncle Cecil. He was born in 1868 and died in 1944. He was a pharmacist. Then there was Jessie Talbot, who died just, she was born in February, died in August 1870, inflammation of the lungs. James Craig Baines, born in 1873, died in 1878, malignant scarlatina. Then my grandpa, John Nelson Darby Ferguson, born July 28, 1875, and he died in April 1958. Then there was Peter McLaren, who lived only a year, malignant scarlatina. Robert Abner Ferguson died from cholera in 1880. And then my great Aunt Susie, and I'll show you pictures of her after, but she was born in November 1883, and she died in November 1986. 103 years she lived. Fantastic. Susanna's brother, Abner, now he was reluctant to run the store in Christville, even though he was going to be set up in the store that his father had with the post office and so forth. So he went prospecting in Pikes Peak, Colorado, Nevada, and he was never heard of from again after sending a letter in 1874. And then he was seen by a Mr. Wells from Riceville in 1884. My great-grandmother's brother, John, he graduated from McGill, and he spent 10 years compiling law books in San Francisco. Then he returned to Ottawa, but he died at McLaren's house on Cameron's Point in Cumberland in 1874. The epitaph on his tombstone at Riceville reads, "Erected to the memory of John Rice McLaren, a graduate of McGill College, Montreal, admitted to the Bar of Quebec 16th of March, 1868, at which time he emigrated to San Francisco, and he was admitted to the Bar of that state 5th of April, 69, formed a partnership with the Honorable M.S.D., with whom he practiced until April 1874, when he returned to Canada, was admitted to the Bar of Ontario in the Court of Chancery 24th August and the Court of Queen's Bench and Common Pleas 27th August 1874. His early death at 28 years, deeply lamented by his relatives, friends, colleagues, and Masonic brethren, by whom this memento of affection is raised. He was a true friend and a highly educated gentleman, and in his profession inferior to none of his age. We saw the gradual opening mind, enriched by all the graces dear, enlightened, social, and refined, in friendship firm, in love sincere. Such was the youth we loved so well, such were the hopes that fate denied. We loved, but we could not tell how deep, how dearly, till he died. He died from typhoid, and his tombstone in Riceville, when we went to see it, vandals had sprayed, you know, paint. It was just up, you know, that little road that you go back up into Clemens there, and it was right up in the corner, a beautiful big tombstone of all spray, which was such a shame. Now, my great-grandfather, is everybody okay? Am I going too fast? Or? Great-grandfather James doctored in the Cumberland area for 60 years. His sons, Willie and Cecil, attended Lisker. Then they went to McGill, and Dr. Willie, he had a beautiful house in Rockland, which was known as Inglehurst, and it was just, the house is still there, but it's quite different, it's a red brick, but it's just right east of the big Catholic church, and the, maybe you can recognize the stone pillars around, like, you know where farmers used to be, if anybody remembered Rockland, and actually the people who had the gas station in Rockland there, in Cumberland, you know, Nancy Dunning worked there. Oh, she had the chip wagon. Anyhow, they lived in there. I forget what their name was. But Dr. Sagan. Sagan's lived there now. But Dr. Major, there's the doctor in Rockland. I think it was Dr. Major in Rockland for a while, Mom? Mm-hmm. Or Major was Arlene. Who was the doctor in Rockland?
Tweedy?
No, after Tweedy. Oh, I can't think of his name.
Corbett.
His office is right there, so you can recognize the stone buildings. But Willie, he had a beautiful house right in Rockland, and as I say, he died in 1912, but he apparently was known to throw wonderful parties, and, you know, we could come up with all sorts of reasons, you know, what did he really die from, I don't know, but my great-aunt Susie, she lived with him in Rockland when her parents moved into the stone house where the old bears is. And my grandparents, John and Annetta Rachel Helmer, they were married in 1897, and they took over the little red house where David Ferguson now lives in Cumberland. Now, David Ferguson is no relation to our Fergusons, but it's quite ironic that he has come back to take over a Ferguson house. Now, the stone house, Clearview, which we always knew as Clearview, is now the Auberge. It was built to be a store in 1880s by William Nelson Dunning. Now, William Nelson Dunning was married to my great-grandmother's sister, Mariah Rice. And their children were Percival, who became a doctor, and Maud Heath. Maybe some of you remember them, but they would have been my grandma's cousins. William then became bankrupt, and so his sister-in-law, Susanna, she bought the property from her sister, Mariah, and then it stayed in the Ferguson family until my sister, Suzanne, and her husband, Hugh McCord, sold it in 1978. It was Jimmy Stevenson who was married to William Hayes' sister who fashioned that marvelous woodwork. And if anyone has been into the Auberge, the beautiful staircase and all the lovely ceiling was fashioned by Jimmy Stevenson, as I say, who was married to William Hayes' sister. Cecil Ferguson married a showgirl from New York, Ada Forbes, and they never had children. He ran the pharmacy in Rockland until the Depression, then he opened one in the Stone House and later moved to Northern Ontario. He died at Chestnut Cottage in 1944. And if anybody can remember him, Mother can remember. I don't know, Joan, if you remember Cecil. But he was a very, only a kid, that's right. You weren't even born then.
Yeah, right.
But he was a very distinguished man, and he's right here. And he was dressed always to the nines. But he liked to drink. And it's often said that even though he was a smart dresser, he often dispensed with the pills, and sometimes he may even have helped himself. You know, he had really, in all honesty, easy access to medication, being a pharmacist, and it may have run in the family, because now John Watson, old John, I remember him telling me that John could remember as a child looking across from Watson's up to the stone house, seeing my great-grandmother walking around the veranda waiting for her husband to come home, and she had this big fur coat on that she was kind of tipsy. So, you know, I think she kind of enjoyed the alcohol too. And it kind of runs in the family. But you know, this was always stuff that was hidden. And then, you know, now everything is out of the closet, so to say, isn't it? Now, my Aunt Susie, she was the one who lived to be 103. She married Lorne Kennedy in 1912. And he was from Maxville, no relation to the Kennedys in the Cumberland area, but he was living in Rockland when they were building the new road through, and they had two daughters, Margaret and Elizabeth, who never married. Let's see, I'll go on through here. James then, when Willie died in 1912, my great-grandfather, James, and his wife Susanna took over the Rockland house, and my Aunt Susie lived in the stone, what I call the stone house, the Auberge, because her husband was away in the war from 1914 to 1918. Then it goes on now, let's see, Susanna, my great-grandmother, she died in 1918, and my great-grandfather died in 21. Now, for people who are interested in the Van Lake Hill area, my great-grandfather's older brother William married a Jesse Jameson from Batlick Hill, and then an Isabel Ramsey, who had been the daughter of Colonel John Ramsey, who was the High Constable of the County of Prescott in 1873. And then William Ferguson was manager of the Hochelaga Bank. That was in Batlick Hill, or where that would be. Was that in Batlick Hill? Maybe the same bank that you're fed?
They used to bank Baltimore.
Really? That's interesting. And he died in 1895. Then another brother, Thomas Ferguson, went to the States to become an architect. And another sister, Elizabeth, married a William Johnson, who lived on the corner of Bank and Wellington, and he was an alderman in Central Ward in 1898. Another sister, Jenny, became a Mrs. Jameson and remained in Batlick Hill. And then another sister was Margaret, and she married Sir Douglas Cameron, after whom the Cameron Highlanders were named, and he was a lieutenant governor of Manitoba. And there was also another sister, Alice, and so forth. So the family, you know, really, like, if any person is ever fortunate enough to have access to their roots, and, you know, many people aren't, you know, we're very fortunate, those of us who are interested in our family, we do have access to diaries or records or whatever. It really, even if you find out that your family wore horse seams or whatever, you know, it does give you a good sense of who you are. And if you see that they lived for a long time and then some of the good they did, or maybe some of the naughty things they did, you realize you're human after all. Now, my grandpa, J.D., some of you people may recall my grandfather, or even worked for him. I hope you paid you.
Not too much.
He went to Belleville, to Albert College, and he was a pharmaceutical salesman. And he accompanied my great-grandfather James on rounds. Now, my grandpa became an evangelist because I think my grandmother Nettie, who was a Helmer from Newington, she didn't like him traveling all over as a salesman in those days because, you know, maybe, who knows, if you have an imagination, you can embellish with false memory syndrome, all sorts of things. But I have here Grandpa's book of collections from 1900 to 1902, and he traveled all over the place, down to Lennoxville, over to Queanbeyan. He was in Buckingham, Thurso, Stansted, all over, and my gracious, here it is, June 5th, 1902, guess where he was? J.T. Bradley, Navan, Ontario, $25. So, I mean, it's just so interesting to look and see a lot of the collections from doctors in Buckingham and Rockland and Clarence and Curran and Sarsfield and all over. So, you know, if people are looking to see names of doctors, especially, or I don't know, Bradley's would have had, you know, medicine or something, general store, all that's right here. Now, my grandpa then became an evangelist, and he was, in all sincerity, a very fervent, staunch Christian, and he preached to many of the school kids in the area, and he was always bona fide about it, you know. I remember my husband Glenn, who is a relation of yours, I think, a cousin, his sister Betty, saying she can remember going to my grandparents' place for Sunday school, and Grandma and Grandpa would have communion in the front. Grandma would have made homemade bread, and there would be the wine, and they'd be doing their service. And my Uncle Fred would be just coming back from Rockland with, you know, cam scarf and some of these people. And, you know, he wasn't, I think he'd been out partying all night long. So Betty said, for some reason, your grandma would get everybody to sing a little bit louder. And I guess Fred would be coming up on the back stairs doing his own song, you know. Thank God I'm pure. Now, my grandpa, let's have a look here. Where am I? Grandpa Ferguson, his name was John Nelson Darby, after the Plymouth Brethren. And he married Annetta Rachel Helmer, who was from Newington. And they had met at the Plymouth Brethren revivals, because in those days they'd have like big camp tent meetings at the turn of the century. And her family tree includes Arbuthnots through marriage. Grandma's brother David married an Arbuthnot. Grace, I think her name was Grace Arbuthnot. So she'd be raised, you know. I mean, when you start looking, it's just amazing. And so Eamons, Parks, Sutherlands, Rombas. And if you go down through Finch and take that road, you see Romba Road and Eamon Road. And I mean, they're all, you know, in our family. And they were United Empire Loyalists. And they were staunch brethren. And then in my dad's family, there was my Uncle James, who was born in 1898, same year as Vic Dunning. And he lived down in the States as a doctor until 1988. And my Aunt Bessie, she was born in 1900. She died in 63. And my Uncle Fred, Frederick William Brad Ferguson, he was born in 1902, died in 66. And then my father, who was born in 1904, and he died in 1965 from cancer. He developed leukemia from the radiation that had worn through him after taking x-rays for so many years. The radiation, he opened practice, what, about 1935, Mom, was it? And his office was at 222 Elgin, right above the Elgin Theater. And over the years, he might take 20, 30, 40 x-rays a day. And I remember the old machine, it, you could practically hear it go zzz, zap. And, you know, there'd be nothing there to protect him. And he died when I was only 15. And then I met Glenn Smith. there was little William Theodore Helmer. He was only 9 years of age when he died, and I talked about him in one of my stories about the train. But he was at school on a Friday with Colin Beaton. And Colin and Beaton shared the same desk, and Colin told me that he was there on Friday, and Monday he was gone. And apparently William had picked up, this was in 1914, maybe it was in September 1914. And I think the war had just started at that time, and that train had gone through in 1908, and it was carrying troops, and apparently he picked up a cigarette. This was always the story, and he developed diphtheria, and they had sent for the medicine, but the steamer went to Rockland instead of stopping at the wharf in Cumberland, and by the time it came for Uncle Willie, he was dead at 9 years of age. So, you know, really, when you think these women and men generations ago, they had like 10, 12, so many children, and they were lucky if three or four of them survived. When I had the Smith family, Glenn's, my husband's family, here's Thomas Smith that came right out of Ireland, Mary Jane Ash, and then William Smith, who married Margaret Law, and in their family Bible, there were so many of them born, and it tells, you know, they lived a month or two, and then two or three children would die at the same time, maybe a two-year-old and a five-year-old, and, you know, it would be just terrible. Maybe this is why everybody wore black all the time, you know, they were always in mourning, for heaven's sake. But we don't realize how well we are now. We say, let's go back to the good old days. I don't know. Let's see. So in my family then, my dad married my mom in 1937, and I have a sister, Suzanne, and then a sister, Charlotte, and Margaret, and myself. Now, I'll just mention a little bit about my husband's family. I think I'm very fortunate in the fact that I'm living right in Cumberland Village on the river, on land that has been in my family since, you know, 1865. It was where our cottage was, and then before that, you know, a garden and so forth. And so there has always been a Ferguson on that land. And I teach at school where my father taught for a while, and it's just, I'm very fortunate. My husband lived down the road just where the Double D Ranch was, and that was their farm for years, and the Smiths were there. I'm not sure how far back. Through the law, like Thomas probably purchased, he came out from Ireland? No.
No, he was up on Rockland.
Okay.
It would have been
this is great. Now, Diana, either Diana, Dorothy Jean. Okay, Dorothy, her mother was Millie Cameron, who would be David's, and then her father, Edward, was Glenn's father's uncle. Yeah, Glenn's uncle. So, I mean, it all, and Are you a Smith also?
No, I'm from the Rolling Hills.
Oh, you're
the way Buckingham.
Are you Mr. Ryan?
No,
you're not Mr. Ryan.
No.
Okay, all right. Well, this is interesting. But now Glenn's family, the Laws, and if you just look at the families though, if anyone knows the area, this weekend, you know, one of our dear friends passed away, I looked at the people. Here's Keith and Glenn as pallbearers, and they're distant cousins. And you just have to look at some of these people, and you can see there's a relation somehow through, whether it be heart disease that they all, you know, or whatever. And William Law came out from Ireland to Clarence Point. This is what from my gather. Correct me if I'm wrong. About 1817, and then His brother John, I think, had come out first, and then it was William and Samuel and Rose. Now, from John Law's family, that's the clan where you have Melvin and Lloyd and all that crew. From William Law's family, that would be Glenn and the Smiths. And then from Samuel Law, that was the Galloways. And if anyone knows the areas, you know, all the Galloways, Clinton, and Buck, and all those fellas, you just have to look at them and you see the same physical look. And, you know, it's interesting in a way. Now, William and Mary, they were, let's see, in the family Bible then, I have that William Smith married Margaret Law. And now they spelt their name S-M-Y-T-H. And I think your mommy told me the story. Why did she ever tell you why?
Why we changed
it? Why it became S-M-I?
I remember my Uncle John saying, I got tired of being called, he's just my.
Yeah.
So he said, we just changed it to Smith.
Because I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Grandfather Robert who changed it, but.
It went back and forth constantly. But my Uncle John Smith, said that he was in that generation that solidified.
Now, I had heard that the SMYTHs were from Buckingham, and they were country people, and they didn't appreciate the Buckingham Smites or Smiths, and they wanted to become a little more citified. So it shows how stories could be so embellished.
Yeah.
But William Smith married Margaret Law, and they had James Edmund in 59, Mary Ash in 1862, Rose Elizabeth in 65, Robert William, who was a grandfather, and he was born in 1867, and then Martha and Maggie, and Martha and Maggie married McCullough's from Tish Russell's family. So, I mean, it's just amazing when you look and see the intertwining. Now, I'm going to finish up here, but I just want to read to you something very special. This is January the 3rd, 1865, and it's from my great-grandfather, James. His picture's around right here somewhere. Let's see. James, I'll pass this right here. You can see some of these pictures. James is writing to his wife, Susie. My dear Susie, you will see that I am in Poughkeepsie. This is Tuesday evening, 10 o'clock. I arrived at 9, have had my supper, find old Mr. Gregory as I left him years ago, and my trunk safe. I have just paid him my bill, $28 in greenbacks, and will now tell you what I find in it. All my class tickets for 3 years, lectures in McGill, neatly folded up as I left them. One dissecting case with 6 knives and scalpels, a Bible, 2 shirts, razor strap, brush, 1 or 2 books in a good trunk. I am very much pleased. In fact, I'm happy that after 4 years and 6 months neglect, I should find my things so safe. I am now within 80 miles of New York City and will go down in the morning to see Professor Draper of the university. If not satisfactory, I will be in Boston in the evening. I left Ottawa Monday at 12:30, reached Prescott at 4, crossed over to Ogdensburg in the evening after a good deal of trouble with the Custom House office. Got off this morning at 4 and have since come 450 miles and a little shaky and will soon retire. I met with a gentleman and lady, Mr. Cowan of the Bank of British North America and his wife at Ottawa and had their company to Albany, which made it very pleasant. They go to Boston to take the English steamer. My dear Susie, I had no idea that I should feel so lonesome as I did on leaving Ottawa. I assure you that it is only a weighty cause that could cause me to leave home thus. However, thus far I have succeeded perfectly and have reason to believe that I will until I return. I hope you will try to amuse yourself as well as you can. Keep up good faith in me this time. I want you to pay Paul McCrae the blacksmith $43.75. which I forgot to leave him. I settled with Mrs. Featherstone, whom I happened to meet in Ottawa. I could not get into Mowat's the tailor, and consequently he paid the $3. I will write you after tomorrow evening or tonight. I am your affectionate husband, James Ferguson. Yes, Willie, or Papa. You cannot write me until I write again. Then on the next letter it says, I will not write much more. I have nothing new to write about of New York. My entire time is taken up with my studies, and now that I'm in examinations, I will keep at my highest degree of nervous tension until it's over. The regular examinations will not begin for 10 days to 2 weeks. If you've sent me the necessary letter before this reaches you, you need not write again, as I will start for home just as soon as the letter comes. Of course, I will have to remain until it comes. Until I see you, goodbye, and kiss dear little Willie for his papa. So that was a precious piece of memorabilia. I have also all of my grandfather, J.D. Ferguson's diaries that he kept from Cumberland Village, and they start about, you know, I've got a couple way back in the 20s, and then mostly the 30s and the 40s and the 50s up until he died, 58. And Joan has seen a few of them, and they tell about, I'm sure, your wedding and various things, the day I was born, and it's marvelous. And if anybody knew my grandpa, you know, it would say, you know, got up at 6 a.m. in the morning, put on the fire, made the porridge, read in the Bible, walked down to the river, got some wood, went up to the store to get the mail, you know, went to bed. Oh, what a busy day. But for him, it was a very busy day. And Mom used to tell me that my grandmother was, she really worked very hard. And she worked. And Grandpa, he did a lot of reading and preaching and walking on the front, I think. But Grandmother would send him up to get something at that time it was done in store. He'd just come back with some sugar and she said, oh, John, I need some butter. So he'd go up again. And from that, our little house, Chestnut Cottage in Cumberland, by the stone house up to Dunning's, it might take him about an hour to walk that far because he would stop and see everyone. Now, this is my father's diary from when he was at Toronto University before he met Mom in 1929, 30, and 31. And it tells mostly about his residence and, you know, his exams and all the things he did in Toronto. But it also tells in the summertime where he was working. And in May the 29th, in 1929, he was looking for work. So he went over to, says, have written a number of letters to contractors and attended a council special meeting at Leonard, where the decision of the Beau Rivière contractors was made for the Bear Brook project. Went over to Buckingham one day to see overseers, but no luck. So he ended up working on that little bridge at Bear Brook, just north of Bear Brook. And they did all the surveying, and I think it was a Mr. Wiggins. And I remember, you can have a look and you'll recognize some of the names of the people that he was with. You know, one day he went down to Rockland with James Morin, and another day there was Urban Lancaster's name mentioned in here. And another time, Colburn's. You know, so they knew all these people. And the connections were just fantastic. So when I retire, you know, in 2 years or 3 years or whatever, this would be a great project to go through and just to see how people lived in those days. When I read this through 2 years in a row, 1929 and 1930, in January, it was so mild, my dad writes down that it was as mild as a summer day. And you know, we think that life is so very different now and that all these things are happening with the world and the weather. But people haven't been keeping records on weather for a long, long, long time. And you know, the same, living and dying and all the things are the same. And I think we learn a lot from our family. So there's lots of things to tell, lots of stories to be told. But I feel that I've spoken enough. There's copies of some of the things that I have put in the family records, and pictures are probably only as meaningful to the people if you know the people, you know. I've even got the death announcements in the paper for a lot of these people. Dr. James' death announcement and so forth. And I'm glad that people kept these things. So it shows, keep these things for your children, and do write on the names of people. So I think I'm going to stop right there. And if anybody has any questions or anything, you know, or any things that they can remember. Like, Mom, I don't know if you want to say anything that you can remember of Grandpa, or, you know, it's just, you remember Uncle Fred?
Oh, yeah. He was a strong man.
He was a very strong man.
He could put his boat in the water and he had a huge boat. He had arms like,
you'll probably know which of your relative it was, but 1888, which would have been the office for recent...
That would have been James.
James was president with my grandfather, Robert, in 1888.
Robert Scar?
Yeah. He, when he went to collect the old age pension, he discovered that there was no Ontario registry of birth, for whatever, no reason. And he had to write to, or probably your father.
To my grandfather.
Grandfather. And who provided him a letter saying that he did in fact attend birth and that it was the stormiest time of the year, and it was March 1st of 1888. So it was a letter of certification that said yes, in fact, the birth was there. And curiously, later on when I was at the Church of Latter-day Saints, I found the actual certificate. And there were a couple of reasons why I couldn't imagine my grandfather. One, he was an only child. The first registry when he was known, he probably was 60 or maybe didn't have any child in the end. And the other thing is that his mother's name was registered as his, one of his aunt's first name. So he never would have found the fact.
I can remember many people, and Mom probably can remember more so, coming to my grandfather's house. And he had, when he walked in the door, he had a great big desk, and he had all the registers and things. And many people would come to verify their age so they could get their pension. But when my father died in 1965, and then my uncle Fred in 1966, the house was sold to Leslie Edwards. And there was a ton of things. They really hadn't kept it very clean. There were tons of things. And we ended up burning a lot of things. And my Uncle James, who was a doctor, he said to my sister Suzanne, you know, there's no sense keeping all these records, because they were medical records of all the people that great grandfather had looked after. And he said, really, that's kind of private information, because it would save, you know, personal things. And now you think, oh, gee, you know, why did they burn them all? It's really wonderful to have Dorothy here too, you know, for the Smith around. But you know, I think of myself now, I bet you anything that great-grandfather Ferguson was probably at the birth of maybe even your grandfather Robert in 1867, because he was the doctor of that area, and certainly Norman and your father Edward, you know. And the connections, it's phenomenal when you see the connections. And I think also, my great-grandfather, he spoke French, because, you know, way back then there was no distinguish between English and French. I don't think it happened until about 1965 or something. But, you know, they would break in Rockland, and I know myself growing up in Cumberland with La Jumonnière and Le Guerrier and so forth, La France, you know, you didn't think of it anything different, you know? And unfortunately, something happened in between. But thank you very much.
Your great-grandfather had time to be reeve, and he was a practicing doctor, and he was reeve of the township.
I think that was in the 1870s sometime.
He must have been working quite
only, I think only for one term.
Yeah, but
I think 1878. But,
and there have been a lot of real estate transactions, I think, through your great-grandfather.
But I think Susanna had done that. I think she looked after
she
that.
Took that.
She took a lot of that stuff. And she always remained Presbyterian. She was very staunch in her, and she never went over to the Brethren. And Aunt Susie, somewhere I've got her pictures around, who lived to be 100, she and Elizabeth were staunch Presbyterian too.
But question actually, yeah. Doesn't the records of the great-grandfather show the epidemics that kind of hit Cumberland? Like, I know there was, you mentioned cholera, but there was also smallpox.
And what year was that now? In 1868? That was the winter of the deep snow that year. Yeah.
Madden's lost, in 1 month, they lost 4 kids.
Yeah. Because I know, and my great-grandmother died in 1918, and you know, I'm just, it could be old age, who knows, but it could very easily have been that terrible flu.
There was a couple of, there was a diphtheria, there was a
diphtheria.
Smallpox.
Typhoid.
Go to the big three.
Water.
They would kind of run through the area. It would decimate sometimes.
And I'm wondering, you know, where a lot of these little babies would be buried, because I know where I live, in Cumberland on the river, right east of me, there were LaSalle's lived, and Mr. LaPage from Sarsfield has just bought that land. But there's the graveyard right there of Salmon Dunning and some of the Dunnings. And then there's a graveyard up at the Camelot. But, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe where I am right now, there could be graves.
They were private.
You know, they were private cemeteries on your own.
The Fool Bears had a private.
They did?
But there is a, I've seen one reference to it, but.
Yeah, because at least, Dale Cemetery for a long time, I think, was just a Protestant cemetery, but now it's, you know, but I don't, I think most of the Catholics have been buried in Rockland or in Orleans. Buckingham. See, the river was narrower. Bob and I can remember. You know, the river was narrower by 20 feet on each side in about 1963, 62. The dam was open at Carrion and. I remember, and I'm sure this is not false memory, but I'm sure I can remember one or two days in that hot summer, but there was hardly any water in the river.
You could go 300 feet towards the middle.
And they must have actually, that must have been the day they were closing the water up by Eddie's or something, and I remember walking out, and it was phenomenal what we found.
And this stuff we found down hole.
And down by LaSalle's, I found a whole lot of fossils that were open, you know, that, and we cut them open. So it's just fantastic.
There's a lot of history there.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank everybody for coming out on this cold night. It's great to see a big crowd. And here's a little token of our appreciation.
Oh, that's hardly a
included is one of our t-shirts, so we're proud.
That's great. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
I want to show you a picture too of your mom. I have a picture of her in this book and your and her sister. Did you see that one? The McMillan twins? Thanks for coming out. I want to show this to Joan. I don't know if you've seen this version before, but I'm sure that there's Fred, but I'm sure that's